And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Every journey begins with its first step. Every story has a beginning. Every hero has an origin. Back to the Bins proudly presents Origins.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Bins. This is the second of our episodes for our brand new segment that we're doing, yet another brand new segment. This one is called simply Origins. If you have not listened to the first Origins episode, shame on you. Go back and give it a listen to so you know what the hell we're talking about. But in short, we're just looking at the classic origin, or origins in this case, because there's multiples, for some classic characters, and we decided to start with the very first character, the Golden Age Superman, the Earth 2, if you will, Superman. And episode 1, we looked at four different versions of the early origin of Superman, and we're just kind of wrapping everything up with the last couple origins that we want to look at for, again, for the Golden Age Superman. I, by the way, am Scott Gardner, and I am joined, as always, by my good friend, David A. Pascarella. How's it going, Dave?
Good, my friend. Good to see you again. In such a short period of time, it's like we're related now.
Shh, don't spoil the magic.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, we just recorded an episode last night together with our good buddy Paul Spataro that they may or may not have already heard by the time they're listening to this. I don't know. We're recording so much stuff, and it's going to go out in like all kinds of random order. So God only knows what order all this stuff's going to actually make it to you, the listener, in. But hopefully it'll all make sense when you're listening to it. But I have an addendum to last episode. So if you remember, there were some mysteries from the last story that we looked at, Superman number 61. That was the one where he followed a meteor back through time to discover his origins, that he actually came from, you know, another planet and all that. There were all kinds of mysteries in that story, like why the hell was he a phantom and how could he understand Kryptonese and all these different things. I just want to throw it out there for the listener. Superman Family, number 202, the man who discovered kryptonite, solves all the mysteries from Superman number 61. Phantom Superman, his understanding Kryptonese, etc. I just read this the other night. I forget where I found out about this, but I know what it was. I was just looking at the characters of that story, Superman 61, and there was the guy's name? Swami Riva?
Yes.
He comes back in that story. He gets, I don't know, he's paroled or escapes from prison or something, but he comes back. And Lois and Clark, because they're married, that's, you know, the whole thing in Superman Family was Mr. and Mrs. Superman. It's that feature. It's that strip. And he comes back. And through recapping that original story and then continuing on that story, we are given some explanation for the things that didn't make a lot of sense. And some of our guesses were right, like the whole Phantom Superman thing is because he's going back to a time period where he already existed. I'll buy that, but if you remember, he turns into a phantom the minute he goes into the time stream, not when he arrives back in Krypton. But I can still, they're fudging, but at least they're trying to explain it. The Kryptonese thing, we nailed that one right on the head. It was because, you know, he comes from an advanced race, his brain is superior, all that sort of thing. And I think you were the one, Dave, that said, you know, he was, what, 6 months to a year old.
Right.
So maybe he had enough exposure that he subconsciously remembers the language, and that was the explanation that was given.
He was doing long division as well at that time.
Right. For everything else, I forget the other mysteries. All I had as a note was just etc. But I know there are other mysteries, and like I say, they are resolved in that story. So I just thought I'd throw that out there because it was actually a fun story. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It was just kind of neat to see that there actually was a sequel of sorts to that story.
Well, you know, it might be fun to revisit that story, you know, in another forum at another time.
Sure.
More in depth.
Yeah. Yeah, I could make a good good bins episode. Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you looked into that and proved once again we were right.
Right. It just proves we read too many damn comic books. That's what it proves.
We have way too much time on our hands. We only put this effort into work, we would have done a lot better.
Right? I'd be running a company by now. We have three books we're going to be looking at tonight. Again, as I say, wrapping up the Golden Age Superman's origins and just kind of looking at, you know, how his origin changed and mutated and warped over time. And we start out with a really interesting one, I think, because I think this one's debatable whether or not it applies. So unless you had anything else, Dave, we can go ahead and just jump right into this if you like.
Yeah, why not?
All right.
We're going to start out tonight with Action Comics 158, which is cover dated July of 1951. Had an on sale date of May 18th, 1951. And you could have picked this beauty up for a mere dime. 10 wow. cents. You know what we should do going forward is look up what these things are going for today.
Oh, right. Well, you know what? I can do that while you run down your synopsis.
The story title is The Kid from Krypton, and it's penciled by Wayne Boring. It's inked by Stan Kay, and the editor is Mort Weisinger. From the cover, we see Superman smiling as he looks through an old photo album, similar to what we all grew up with years ago, before everyone just took pictures and never did anything with them, with a full-page photo of a baby lifting a refrigerator with one hand. How did Superman get his superpowers? What is his one vulnerable spot? You'll find the answers in Superman's personal album when you read The Kid from Krypton. Splash page. Superman appears paralyzed by a ray from a meteor headed directly for him. While nothing of earthly origin can harm Superman, there is only one thing from outside the earth that can harm him. That is fragments of his dead homeworld, Kryptonite. In an observatory on a high mountain, a large meteor is discovered heading directly towards Smithville. The warning to evacuate Smithville comes across the wire at the Daily Planet. Lois comments to her co-workers, including Clark Kent, "Superman could save the town, if only he knew." A mere panel later, Superman is en route to stop the meteor. In Smithville, the fleeing people cheer Superman's arrival, but as he approaches the meteor, he feels helpless and groggy. Superman fears the meteor is made up of pure kryptonite and is soon left completely paralyzed. The fourth wall is broken by a mysterious voice, and we are asked, "Why does this substance have a harmful influence on Superman? We must look to his origin for answers. Once, far from Earth, there was a great planet, Krypton, populated by a race of physically perfect people, blessed with immense intelligence and science. Due to Krypton's incredibly stronger gravity, a Kryptonian on Earth could move mountains and fly through the air. However, all was not well on Krypton. Quakes rocked the planet. Their lead scientist, Jor-El, spelled J-O-R-E-L, discovers there are forces building within the planet's uranium core that will result in the planet exploding like an atomic bomb. When Jor-El brings his findings to the council, he is dismissed as a madman. The day of Krypton's end arrives far sooner than expected. Jor-El and his wife Lara place their child in a prototype rocket and launch him into the void of space, hoping he may find a chance at life on some other world. Moments later, Krypton explodes into fragments. The baby lands on Earth and is found by the elderly Kents. The rocket self-immolates, leaving no trace of its existence. The Kents adopt the child, naming him Clark Kent. Clark gradually exhibits his superpowers. As his father lies dying, he tells Clark, "Your superpowers made you a champion of right as Superboy. Now you must continue your role as Superman, but always keep your true identity hidden." Superman's powers and invulnerability become well known. His only weakness is to the rays of fragments from the planet Krypton that have been changed by the atomic explosion of the planet and morphed into a new element, Kryptonite. In the present, as the media continues towards Smithville, Superman falls away from the influence of the Kryptonite. Once revived, he grabs a huge boulder and uses it like a bowling ball to knock the Kryptonite meteor off course, causing it to land harmlessly outside Smithville. Unknown to Superman, a crook has observed the events as they transpired and has determined that the meteor must be made of Kryptonite. He quickly informs Racket's boss, Kane Kor-El, who sets out to retrieve the Kryptonite meteorite and sell its fragments to every crook in Metropolis. As Superman contemplates how to dispose of the Kryptonite meteorite, Kor-El arrives and carts off the meteor. Helpless to stop them, Superman tries to follow, but is soon knocked out by a blast of Kryptonite dust. Upon his revival, Superman creates two robots to assist him in neutralizing the Kryptonite threat. His efforts fail, but he develops a K-detector. In no time, Kryptonite has flooded Metropolis, and with criminals fearless, crime runs wild. Such large quantities of Kryptonite are in the city that at one point Superman in his Clark Kent guise is affected, and Lois becomes suspicious. Quickly, Clark pierces a gas line and shows Lois the leaking gas as the cause of his faintness. Superman has an idea. He installs his K-detector in his robots and uses them to hunt down and retrieve the Kryptonite from the crooks in Metropolis. Enraged, the crooks head for the hideout of Kor-El and his Kryptonite syndicate to seek a refund for their lost Kryptonite. Superman follows the criminal convoy. Superman arrives at the hideout with a large crate strapped to his back and begins to tunnel into the earth. Suspecting that Superman is planning to tunnel under the meteorite and bury it in the earth, they push the meteorite into the tunnel behind Superman, hoping to kill him. However, when the meteorite impacts the crate, it causes a tremendous explosion. While the explosion is harmless to Superman, the detonation launches the meteorite back into space. With the assistance of his robot, the remaining fragments are gathered up and loaded into a giant slingshot, which Superman uses to send them into space. Superman hopes no further Kryptonite fragments will arrive on Earth. The end, minus at the end in the story, just stops.
Yep. Hard break. Yeah, it stops so suddenly and does not say, wait a minute, does it? Oh, you know what? I don't think you could see this on the page, but if you zoom in, because I have it on my iPad, in teeny tiny lettering down in the bottom right corner in the rock work, it actually does say the end.
Oh. Yeah, well, when you it
ends so abruptly that initially I thought pages were missing from this scan or something that I'm looking at it, but...
Yeah, well, you know, when you get to my age, you're lucky you see the panel, so... What am I, Columbo? I'm going to examine... So what'd you think of this?
I liked it, and it's interesting. I really like the art.
Yeah, the art's great.
I'm a total mark for Wayne Boring, so I really liked the art in this. This one is a strange beast because, again, it's recapping the origin. It's hitting most of the same beats that we've looked at. You know, it's pretty much the established origin. But again, here we are with Wayne Boring telling this story that he told so well in Superman number 53. And it's so different in the art. I mean, the Kryptonian outfits are completely different. The look of Jor-El and Lara's place. The rocket is completely different. It's just really weird.
Jor-El and Lara look like they're almost sitting in a regular living room.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, if it wasn't for Jor-El's, you know, funky futuristic looking outfit, yeah, it would just look like an apartment in the 50s, you know. And she looks like she's dressed for like a Christmas party or something. Like she's one of the Rockettes or something. I don't know. It's a weird looking, like Christmassy looking outfit she's got on. I got a bunch of notes on this one, so I'll just kind of run through. I love the cover on this. This is the cover I call, Ma, don't put that shit in the family album. Because it's got a picture of baby Clark holding the refrigerator over his head. I just love that. You know, so anybody that comes over to the cat home, if Ma gets out the photo album, his secret identity is completely blown. And you know moms like to dig out the photo album and show the baby pictures, so...
I got a question that goes in with that since you're on that specific issue.
Sure.
Is one of the Kents, you know, like, is photography their hobby? Because I'd like to know where they got this picture developed.
Ah, that's a great catch. Yes, I hadn't thought of that.
The photo mat guy is looking at this going, holy jeez, look at this.
That's an excellent point. Yes. Yeah, how would you get that developed? Because this was still at a time where the Kents were simple farmers. I mean, not to say a farmer couldn't learn to develop his own film, I guess, but, you know, it's not like they had the Kent General Store and, you know, that, you know, like if this were that version of the Kents, then I would say, well, maybe they have like a film developing thing in the back room or something. But yeah, no, and this, yeah. So yeah, that's a great catch.
I mean, think about it. In the mid-70s, when I remember, most places where you got the film done didn't even do it there. They sent it out.
Right, right.
Like, okay, it'll be ready in 2 weeks. Come back then.
You're absolutely right. Again, it just bears mentioning, I love the art in this. I really do. It's kind of strangely colored, but somehow it works. I really like that. Panel two. So... Standing around at the Daily Planet, says, presently in the Daily Planet office in Metropolis, the teletype chatters the dread news. And you've got Lois reading the teletype, and she says, Smithville warned to evacuate. Town will be destroyed by meteor. Superman could save the town if only he knew. And Clark says, there's only a little time, but I'll try to find him, Lois. And then, you know, he streaks off and actually becomes Superman. And Lois and Perry are standing right there, and I'm just thinking... Do Lois and Perry actually know that he's Superman and they're just humoring him all this time? Because this whole thing where, and I didn't realize it came along this early in the Superman lore, but this is one of those things that even as a kid really bugged me. The fact that Superman and Clark were assumed to be really chummy and like Clark would go off and signal for Superman. And I'm thinking, okay. The whole disguise is flimsy enough as it is, but now you're just making it ridiculous. You're making your coworkers seem like they're really, really, really stupid if they can't start to put all this together after a time. And plus, they're reporters. I mean, how dumb does it make them look? You know,
Tempest and Lois and Clark. Remember, you must have seen that, right? Tempest, the time traveler, and Lois and Clark. That series.
I never did watch. I watched the pilot of that show, and that was the all I ever watched.
There's a guy from the future who shows up, and, you know, he basically tells Lois, he says, they look back at this time, and the question everyone has is, how dumb was she?
That's awesome. Who plays him, do you know?
I don't remember. I don't, but he was hysterical because he's like a bad guy. Everyone knows you two are, you know, the pillars of our society, but the one question is, how dumb was she? And he's got like glasses. He goes, Superman, Clark Kent, Superman, Clark Kent, duh.
Now, did she finally figure it out on that show? I never, like I say, I never watched it. So did he reveal himself, or she figures it out?
He's all set to reveal himself. And she goes, I have something to tell you. She goes, yeah, you're Superman.
Oh, okay. I like that.
The show was good. Yeah, it really was good. I enjoyed it.
I need to probably go back and give it a look at some point. Same page, fourth panel. I just really like this. This is as the panic-stricken residents flee their doomed town, and you've got Superman kind of flying over. You know, the streets are clogged. You've got these old-timey vehicles. You've got people carrying all their possessions. This really, really, really reminded me of the mass exodus from Los Angeles in the 50s version of War of the Worlds. And I just really liked that. I thought that was really neat. Actually, I think this story probably predates that by a little bit, but it's still cool. It still reminded me of it. Kryptonite is not green yet in this particular story. Page 3. Talk of the gravitational differences between Krypton and Earth as an explanation for the superpowers. Is this the first time we're seeing this? Because I think it is.
I think they may have alluded to it, but they did not specifically spell it out.
Right. Because here, we don't get the, you know, it says that they are physically perfect and intelligent and all that, but we don't get the superpowered, at least we're not seeing a demonstration of them, like, leaping an eighth of a mile and all that. So now they are actually starting to draw differences between, you know, Krypton and Earth and that sort of thing, and, you know, gravitational and all that. And I just found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, they're getting stronger and stronger and smarter and smarter.
This has got to be Jor-El's ugliest outfit, I'm thinking. Now, the one that he wore in More Fun 101, which we did not look at, but the one he wears in that, in Superboy's origin, that one's pretty horrid, too. But yeah, this one, ugh.
And the symbol on his chest, what the hell is that?
It's like the Reverse Flash or something, yeah.
He looks like he's ready to go Shazam!
Yeah, it's weird. It's so different from all the other outfits we've seen him wear. That's the strange thing. Yeah, like, everything is different. So that's really weird. Page 3, last panel. Oh, I like the dialogue. So it's, you know, after Jor-El warns the people, he's rejected by the people, and he goes back to his apartment and everything, and he's sitting in his apartment with Lara. And she just says, but why? Why wouldn't the people believe? And he says, men often reject a truth that is too terrible to face. They are afraid to believe. I just kind of like that. That's different. That's something we haven't seen before in the origin story. I just kind of liked the dialogue there.
Let me throw in on that note with the, despite the Kryptons, and I'm quoting here, immense intelligence and science, they neither foresaw the destruction of Krypton, nor apparently could use a doorknob.
Now, it just bears reiterating that even if the council had totally bought into Jor-El's theory and totally agreed to build a fleet of space ark, mm-hmm. they only had until mid-afternoon the same day to do it. Because you know, later that day is when the planet blows up. So ultimately, in this version of the origin, it really doesn't matter that the council laughed him out of the room. Because even if they'd have been like, you know what, you're right, let's get to work. Oh, shit, too late.
Well, it'd be like, you know, the planet's going to explode. Oh, my God. When, Jor-El? 2 o'clock this afternoon.
It begs the question, like, when did he know? Did he just find this out? Because if he knew this well in advance, he shouldn't have sat on that information so long. Because he was anybody else a chance.
He was working on the slides for his PowerPoint presentation.
Now, Jor-El, as we said before, you know, Jor-El and Lara's clothes and home have changed in every retelling of this. This is the most drastic one. Now, this one's funny because it literally looks like the rocket is in the middle of their living room, and it also looks like it's unable to be launched until a wall
fortuitous for them.
Yeah, I mean, if it hadn't been for that wall falling down, how are they intending to launch this rocket? Because we don't see any opening or a window or anything.
This rocket also looks like the hood ornament on an Oldsmobile 88.
Yeah, it does. It's really, I mean, so completely different than, you know, all the other versions we've seen so far. Page 4, panel 4, this bit of dialogue, it kind of, I don't know, see what you think of this. So we have Jor-El and Lara watching the rocket launch, and Jor-El says, and this is another thing that changes in almost every iteration of his origin, is what they actually say. In this one, Jor-El says, may he land safely on some other world.
Mm-hmm.
Did he not even know where he was sending the baby to? Did he not program in, like, a specific destination?
Right, he didn't. It's just like, well, peace out. Hopefully you hit a planet that will sustain life.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm thinking. So
that's why they weren't going with go with the baby. No, that's okay. Take my chances here.
I mean, I get it that, you know, the planet's about to blow up and they're trying to save it. I get all that, but they're just this gives the impression they're just blindly launching him out.
Yes.
And that's, I don't know. That's weird. It's all, but then it ties into that whole Moses parallel, I guess, because, you know, that's kind of what happened with Moses, right? The mother just kind of cast him down river to whatever, right?
Yeah. Yes, to save him.
Huh. The growing up and discovering his power sequence is now condensed to just one single panel. So we get him lifting the refrigerator, so super strength, X-ray vision, and a mention of invulnerability all in the one panel there. So, you know, greatly condensed in that. The big thing with this, though, is that not only is Jor-El spelled with the E-L instead of the L, which normally is a differentiator between the Earth 1 and Earth 2 versions, but also, you know, the big one in this is the mention of Superboy.
Right.
So Superboy is actually mentioned on Pa Kent's deathbed. And this will be something I think we'll really have to talk about and see how we fall on this. But personally, I'm still placing this more in the realm of Earth 2 Superman because it's still technically the Golden Age. And we would see eventually with Superman number 146, 10 years from here, that the next major retelling of the origin is considerably different and fully incorporates Superboy, and to my mind is really the delineating line to where you're now like, okay, we are officially at Silver Age, Earth One, Superman, and there's no ambiguity with that. So this one's still a little bit ambiguous, but I'm personally leaning more towards this still falls technically within the Golden Age. What do you think?
I think it can get away being in the Golden Age. If you really want to draw such a hard and fast line, the Golden Age Superman lasts a very short period of time.
Right.
I mean, you might even be able to argue, other than the first few issues and the newspaper strip, everything then is the Silver Age, which it's right. Not.
Right.
It's not.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we can no prize this and say he was just, you know, a great kid and he was helping people out and stuff on the QT. And, you know, it's like, oh, you were a super boy as opposed to, you know, flying around in a costume.
Right.
I think you have to no-prize it like that. I mean, clearly there was no Earth 1, Earth 2 at this point.
Right, right. This is all retrospective. Yeah, exactly.
And the world he's operating on at that time is the Golden Age one with all the other Golden Age characters.
Right.
So I think we no-prize this as a spelling error with Jor-El. And, you know, he's a super boy, not Superboy.
Right. Well, by this point, there were Superman stories referencing his time as Superboy and everything. So the whole thing gets very muddy because Superboy technically is a Golden Age character because he debuted in, what was it,
45, I think.
Like that. But he also kind of signals, you know, the first major change, you know, with the character. And, you know, like I said last time, you know, Mike Voyles, you know, makes the case that technically that's the beginning of the Earth One continuity. I can kind of buy that. But right. It does, you know, it muddies the waters greatly. So I don't think that there ever was a very definitive hard line, like, here is the differentiator between Earth 1 and Earth 2 Superman. I think the whole thing is very muddy. So, you know, this is just another example of that.
If we had never had the great contraction of comics in the 1950s, superhero comics, if they had just kept rolling along and they didn't change, you still had Jay Garrick as the Flash, and yeah, Superboy would have been a clear Golden Age character.
Right. You ever played croquet?
Me? No.
No? I played a little bit when I was a kid. And as I recall, when, you know, you would hit a ball and it would hit another ball, the ball that you hit would then stop where it was and then send the other ball. So I'm wondering what happened to the boulder that Superman throws to knock the kryptonite off course, because the impact we're seeing over the town of Smithville. So if my limited understanding of physics and how this sort of thing works, that boulder is going to fall on somebody. And, you know, so it's essentially posing the exact same danger to the citizenry as the kryptonite did.
Right.
So I just kind of wonder how, like, what happened to the boulder? We don't really see that. We just see the two of them impacting, and then we see the kryptonite kind of bounce out of town. It says, you know, crashes harmlessly outside of town, but what about the boulder itself? What did it crash into?
I would no-prize. I'm good at no-prizing. I would argue that it wasn't a head-on impact, that it was a glancing blow, just enough to shift the media one way and the boulder went the other way and landed on some poor farmer's house, killing him and his wife and two children. But hey, the good of the many outweighs right, away, crossing the streams a bit.
My last note on this one, who is the writer on this? Do we know who the writer was?
I couldn't find a writer. I looked on Mike's Amazing World. I didn't see anybody listed. And there's nothing listed in the book.
I hate to come right out and say that it's poorly written, but the word baleful, which is a strange word to begin with, is used 4 times in this story.
I know, that's why I changed it when I did the synopsis.
I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just thought that was really kind of strange. Like, did the writer just not have a thesaurus sitting next to his desk when he wrote this, or what, you know? To use the same odd word 4 times within just a few pages seemed really odd to me. But that's it for me. That's all I've got for notes on this one. What have you got?
I'll throw in a few more minor notes here. Again, Superman has no name. We're not given Kal-El yet. We have the trope of Lois suspecting Clark is Superman, and he gets out of it by causing a gas leak. We get the primitive versions of Superman's robots, which by the 60s will have been proved to, they look exactly like him. I think they last until the 70s, right? Doesn't it go into the 70s?
Yeah, I think so.
Nothing can contain kryptonite at this point, including lead, apparently. Which that'll change as we go on.
Right.
And other than we mentioned kryptonite is not green, that's everything I've got.
I just noticed in the explosion that sends the kryptonite back. Superman says it sends it back into space, and I'm thinking, no, that doesn't work that way. But anyway, even if it did, doesn't that explosion look like it's blasting off pieces of the meteor as it leaves the hole?
Yes.
So I'm thinking it still leaves kryptonite behind, so shouldn't he still be weakened and everything? I don't know. It's
it's poorly drawn. It's poorly drawn. It's probably supposed to be like pieces of Earth falling into the hole.
Right.
I mean, this kryptonite thing, it seems like it's relatively easy to chisel off a piece because the guy pulverizes it, you know, to make the dust.
Right.
But yet, a big explosion like that doesn't leave anything behind in the hole.
I would think it would just blow the meteor apart rather than have enough force to actually send. I mean, come on now. I mean, these are just conventional explosives. I mean, look how much fuel it takes to launch like a rocket into space. Just simply having a couple of cases in TNT is not going to be enough to send a boulder into orbit. So that was really rather silly, I thought.
Well, have you seen some of those rockets we tried to launch in the 50s that fell right back down?
Right.
There you go.
Yep. What do you think? You want to do grades on this one?
Sure, why not? You go first.
I like the cover. It's very simple. It's just, you know, Superman smiling as he's flipping through the old family album. You know, nothing terribly dynamic about it, but it's a cute cover. It works. I say a B on the cover. It's pretty good. I think it's a pretty fun image. Interior art, I really dig the interior art. The coloring's a little bit weird, but again, I'm a total mark for Wayne Boring. So yeah, I really enjoyed the art in this. I'm going to say a B on the art as well, because I have seen better from him, and I hope I'm not denigrating him because it's because of the coloring, because I have no idea who colored this. So, you know, it might not be fair to Boring's art, you know, to knock it down a little bit just because the coloring's a little bit weird. But overall, I really like this. I continue to be mystified by why does Krypton look different every single time, even though it's by the same artist. That's just so bizarre to me.
And it's always a golden color.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really weird. And then the story, I gotta be honest, the story is pretty dopey. It wasn't horrible or anything, but it's not a great story. But I mean, it's semi-typical for this particular era. So story-wise, I'm going to say a C+. It was a little bit better than average, but overall, it was pretty dopey. So great on this one overall. I'm going to say I'll say a B- as an overall grade. It was pretty good. It was pretty enjoyable. And I just looked at the first story. I didn't look at anything else in the book.
Yeah, I didn't look at anything else either. I'm not going to beat a dead horse because I can literally say ditto. Those are exactly what my grades were. B on the cover, B with the art, C+ on the story, B- overall.
All right. So for our next book, we're going to jump ahead. Let's see, what year was your book? 51?
51.
51, all right. So we're jumping ahead just a little bit in time, just a couple of years. Jumping ahead until 1953, we're going to take a look at Three Dimension Adventures number one. I think last time I called this Three Dimensional Adventures number. That is not correct. It is Three Dimension Adventures. It is better known as Superman 3D. I discovered this because when we were looking at the books that we looked at last time, several places online list Superman number 53 that we looked at, you know, the origin of Superman, you know, the first major origin of Superman, list that as being reprinted in this book. It is not. So, like I say, despite being noted in several online sources, the story we're going to look at here is not reprinted from Superman number 53 in 1948. But what's really cool, as we're about to discover here, there are some really remarkable similarities. So, for one, while there are no credits in the book for this story, it's pretty likely that it was written by Bill Finger. The art is by Wayne Boring, and it's probably Stan Kay on the inks. So more than likely the exact same team from Superman 53. Both stories open to a full page, it's a full title page, heralding the feats and abilities of our hero and asking where did he come from and how did he obtain his amazing powers, and promising answers in the exciting story of the origin of Superman. So also like Superman number 53, his Kryptonian parents look on proudly as his rocket ship speeds away from their exploding planet, although this time it's Jor-El who waves goodbye. Also, Superman on this page is deflecting airplane machine gun fire off his chest as opposed to holding his head and looking distressed. So page two is again, now this is, you know, the first page of the story, so page two is again remarkably similar to that of Superman number 53, right down to the layouts of the panels. Superman saving a bus, Superman deflecting artillery shells, Superman using his x-ray vision to spot a crime, Superman smashing a giant Luthor robot, and Superman rebuilding slums. What is incredible to me is that while every sequence is exactly the same, each issue features unique artwork by presumably the same team, or at least the same primary artist, you know, that being Wayne Boring. So I can only speculate that this was done because it would have been really difficult to 3D-ize the original story, maybe?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, maybe they didn't still have the original art, like in black and white or whatever, because, you know, they did these stories back then in black and white, and then they would create one version of it that was inked blue and one version that was inked red. And it's when you would put on the 3D glasses, you know, one lens is blue, one lens is red, that the image would come together and form a three-dimensional image. And I'm just assuming that they couldn't do that with the original Superman number 53 story for whatever reason. So they basically redrew it, but redrew it with basically the same story beats, but the art is different, which is just, I don't know, it's just kind of fascinating to me.
I'll bet you some of it's too, you know, like the image, the way it was drawn, the way the bus is coming up, if you had the 3D glasses, it would probably look like the bus was coming at you.
Right, right.
As opposed to the way the car was being lifted.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah, I'm sure some of these, I did not look at this in 3D. Somewhere in this house, I have an old pair of the blue and red 3D glasses. I'll be damned if I know where they are. I have a copy of this in 3D, but I just didn't have time to dig it out and take a look at it. So I'm not sure, you know, how good or bad the 3D is. I would imagine it probably pops. I tried to find out if this was a Ray Zone 3D, and I could not seem to find any verification of that. But if you're curious, you know, just Google Ray Zone. He was a guy that that basically built his reputation on 3D. He was an innovator of 3D, particularly 3D comics back in the day. This was more than likely his work, but I don't know that for sure. Let's see. Page three is also similarly laid out to the third page of the origin in Superman number 53, but with the difference of being reduced to four panels as opposed to 53's six panels. The story progression is basically the same. First panel introduction of Krypton in space, following panel showing the people and civilization of the planet, complete with a couple discussing their young child. This time, however, Junior is behind in algebra instead of calculus. We get the ground quake in panel 3 and Jor-El proclaiming Krypton is doomed before the Council of Five in the last panel. Things switch up significantly, however, on page 4 as Jor-El not only explains that Krypton's core is composed of uranium, but actually waves a large glowing brick of the substance around while he makes his speech. Congratulations to the Council of Five. You're all sterile.
and have cancer.
Yeah, exactly. If the planet hadn't exploded, they would have died of cancer anyway. So, so Jor-El even breaks out a film projector, just like in science class, to demonstrate his idea of building space arcs to whisk everyone away to the planet Earth. Again, as always, the Council scoff at these theories and basically run him out of the room. Jor-El, beaten, curses the blind fools and rushes home to his family, hoping there is time to save his wife and baby. But he no sooner arrives than the final quakes begin. Jor-El calls for his wife and child to board the ship, but she refuses to leave his side. And so the infant is rocketed away, the sole survivor of the exploding planet. The force of the rocket blast is so great, it even knocks Jor-El's headband off of his head in the first panel of page 6. The shots of the buildings collapsing, the planet exploding, and the rocket zipping through space are all remarkably similar. The arrival of the rocket is different only in that the model of the Kent family car has changed, and both occupants are now seated in the front of the vehicle. Also, the landing site is named in this version a farm near Smallville, USA. Everything that follows on the next page is the same again, yet re-illustrated, right down to the dialogue. The Kents discovering the baby and turning him over to the orphanage, the rocket burning up and leaving no trace behind, and the baby demonstrating remarkable feats of strength, although this time the nurse says he'll grow up to be a Samson as opposed to a Hercules. A doctor still breaks needles trying to vaccinate him, and the baby still dangles from light fixtures. The adoption is rushed through to get rid of him before he can wreck the joint, and the joyous Kents name their new son Clark. The following page features 5 panels instead of the 6 that were in number 53 needed to tell the same sequence. Clark is a young boy being hit by a tractor and surviving unscathed while the tractor is wrecked, outrunning an express train, leaping a fence and being carried clear over the Kent home, and discovering he has X-ray vision, although this time it's to detect cherry pie in the oven as opposed to finding his mother's spectacles. The final page, also reduced by one panel, finds Clark at his dying father's bedside and the by now familiar advice to keep his identity a secret but to use his great powers to help others. It is important to note that there is no mention whatsoever of Superboy. Clark stands over his parents' grave, this time shown as Jonathan and Martha as opposed to John and Mary. And the oath to get a job as a reporter, hide his identity behind a facade of meekness and a pair of glasses, and but then to appear in costume as Superman. And that's pretty much it. So it is largely just like Superman number 53, but just odd that it's completely redrawn.
Yeah, that's my main note. The change in the iconography associated with Superman's powers, which to some extent I think looks really cool, to be blunt.
Yeah.
I really like on the opening splash page. I'd like to say it's an Avenger fighter plane that's shooting at him, the guy in the back, but I'm pretty sure that's not where the machine gun was mounted.
Yeah, because if he swings the machine gun to try to take out an aircraft that's coming head on, then he's going to shoot the pilot in the back of the head.
It only faces out the left side of the plane. Keep all the bad guys to the left. It's a subtle thing about communism. Enemies on the left. Was the 50s, right?
Right.
On page 2, the artillery firing at him, to me, that's one of the coolest shots on the page. And I could only imagine in my mind's eye what it would look like in 3D with maybe the shell headed off to you. The X-ray vision shot is probably a really cool 3D shot, too.
I've got to dig out those glasses and take a look at this, because I bet you're right. I bet you this looks really cool in 3D. That shot with the bus probably does look like the bus is coming right out of the panel at you.
Right, that's what I'm thinking. I like they go back to Superman being a social crusader, rebuilding slums. The Krypton scenes are very cool. The shot there of Krypton with the, I'm going to assume it's a moon with the ring around it.
Right.
It's just a very cool shot.
Yeah.
Jor-El with his projector. Like out of a science class when we were in grammar school. We're going to roll in the projector and show you a film.
It's film strip day. Yay!
Now, it's funny. If you look at the center panel on the right-hand side of that page, they must have screwed up with the word bubble, because it looks like Jor-El is saying, we've had quakes on Krypton before, and it still stands.
Yep.
So I'm assuming that's an error. Same thing on the next page with Lara refusing to leave, to stay at Jor-El's side. The rocket is very cool. The destruction of Krypton. And the orphanage is fun, right?
This rocket, I'm noticing, is kind of an amalgam between the rocket as we would come to know the look of it and the rocket as we just saw in the last story that we looked at. It's kind of a melding of the two styles.
It seems like it depends on the angle you're looking at it.
Yeah.
How come Earth has two moons?
Oh, I didn't even get, oh my God, I didn't even get
I just that. Noticed that now.
Wow.
All right, I can understand being a little off on how many moons Krypton has, but I'm pretty sure the Earth has always had two.
I don't know. I wasn't what around man? In the 50s. Maybe we did have two moons. I don't know.
They're really keeping consistent with this. The rocket burns itself up.
So. Yep. It's funny that you should bring that up, because I got to be honest, in my mind, the biggest differentiator between Golden Age and Silver Age, you know, essentially Earth 2 and Earth 1 Superman origins, is the rocket.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really the delineating line, because so I looked ahead a little bit, looking at other origins, because this, you know, to my mind, this is the last Golden Age origin, the last origin of the Golden Age Earth 2 Superman actually set in the Golden Age. Because, you know, the next book we're going to look at is, again, Golden Age Superman, but, you know, it's looking back. So the next major origin after this, you know, the next major retelling is Superman number 146. Which is clearly Silver Age Superman. But in that one, that's where they began with the rocket landed, or actually crashed, rather, and Kal-El was thrown clear, and the rocket exploded, but it didn't burn up. So that's how they were able to, you know, later on, Clark goes back and takes the pieces of the busted windshield to make his glasses and all that. So, I mean, there's a clear delineating line, at least with those two versions of the origin. And, you know, of course, the latter one in 146, fully incorporates Superboy and all, you know, all that lore that, you know, would come along from that, you know, with the blankets and the super play suit when he was a kid, all that stuff comes from that version of the origin. So that really is the biggest differentiator to me.
Well, you just said something. Give me one vamp a second, because I just want to check something out here.
One thing I noticed that I found really interesting is in that origin in Superman 146, the opener of that, again, does the same five sequences to to start the story. So it recaps his powers with him once again saving a bus. Once again, something bouncing off of him. In this case, it's actually an atomic rocket. So an A-bomb, essentially. So he's, again, you know, there's a dear, you know, clear differentiator, because I don't think the Golden Age Superman could take an A-bomb. Using his X-ray vision, fighting a giant Luther robot, and cleaning up the slums. So, yeah, they kept doing those same beats for these origins.
You know what? Clearly, in this particular story, what I would argue 100% makes this the Golden Age.
What's that?
When it shows Pa Kent dying and yeah. Clark standing over him or sitting next to him, he is not wearing glasses.
Right.
So if there was a Superboy, there would be no Superboy, because why would Clark be wearing glasses?
Right. In that one we just looked at, the Action 158, he was wearing glasses at his dying father's bedside. So again, that's another thing that makes that one a little bit muddier to place. Overall, though, what did you think of this one versus the original, basically the original version of this from Superman 53?
I liked 53, but I got to be honest with you, I liked this one too.
Yeah.
And the art I like particularly. I don't know whether it's that it was jazzed up, you know, because of the 3D or what, but it really looks great.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. I like the one from 53 better, but that's probably sentimentality talking, because I'm much more familiar with that version, having seen it and read it so many times since I was a kid. But I like this too. This looks really sharp. And Jor-El looks pretty much like quintessential Jor-El. His tunic's a little bit different, but otherwise, you know, he's got the big, the big sun on his chest, and you know, the look that would become kind of quintessential Jor-El, especially like Silver Age Jor-El. He looks very much like Silver Age Jor-El.
Yeah, definitely. That's great.
I liked this. I thought it was cool.
You know, I'm just looking at where he gets hit with the tractor. And the guy says, gosh, you're not even hurt. The tractor looks like it's completely destroyed. Clark should be saying the same thing to him. Oh, my God, and you're not hurt either.
Sorry, you're crippled now.
This is a great issue.
I just noticed that in the last panel on the page where he's using his X-ray vision to see the pie in the oven, that's Silver Age Ma and Pa Kent right there. That's, I think this is the first time we've seen them depicted looking pretty much like their Silver Age versions.
Yeah, they don't look ancient.
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't look like an old school marm, and he's not like an old, balding, like, kind of scrawny dude.
Right. Definitely.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's pretty much all I've got on this one. I dug it. I thought it was pretty cool. It's a neat little historical artifact.
Now, did you read the other stories in the book?
I did not. No. Just for time reasons, I just didn't have time. They look interesting. I really do need to find some glasses and read this proper in the 3D, although one review I was reading of it said, you know, you got to take it in you know, bite-sized chunks, because it'll give you a nasty headache by the time you get to the end of it if you try to do it all at once. So
it's like that eyeglass thing in the movie The Jerk. You remember that with Steve Martin?
You know, I've never seen that movie.
Oh, my God. It, like, made people cross-eyed or something like that. The other two stories I read them, you could save your time. You could save your time.
Well, are we ready for that last book?
Yes, indeed. Let me just get my notes here. All right. To wrap this up, we have Secret Origins Number 1. Cover date of April 1986. On sale date, January 9th, 1986 at a cost of 75 cents. Now, this, of all these books we've covered, this is the only one that I bought off the newsstand for the 75 cents, no less. I still have that book.
Yep. I bought it. I bought this for the first, probably the first year or two. I since have collected the entire series, but at the time I collected it for a time up until it started to do characters I really didn't care much about. But yeah, I distinctly remember buying this one, right off the stand and everything. In April of 86, of course, you know, it was came out earlier than that, but the cover date, April 86, I would be 18 years old.
Now, our writer on this is Roy Thomas, penciler Wayne Boring, inker Jerry Ordway, letterer David Cody Weiss, colorist Eugene D'Angelo, and editor Roy Thomas. And the title of this issue is The Secret Origin of the Golden Age Superman, which kind of explains why we're doing a book from 1986 that's covering the Golden Age Superman. And we start out from 1938 until 1985's Crisis on Infinite Earths. The Golden Age Superman, Kal-El, single L, was the Superman of Earth 2, a living, breathing force for good. He vanished forever into oblivion of the antimatter universe. This is his story. Krypton was a sizable planet in the system Negus 12, with massive gravitational pull, three satellites, and many natural wonders. The humanoid inhabitants, by Earth standards, were a super race, capable of prodigious strength, speed, and vitality. Kryptonians possessed the ability to outrace the fastest human-made projectiles and to leap the tallest structures with little effort. The story opens with Jor-El racing home at top speed, leaving speed lines behind him, leaping over skyscrapers and into the upper story window of his high-rise residence. His wife, Lara, relates to him how their rather large newborn son is already exhibiting great strength and has given his doctor a black eye. A quake strikes, the latest and largest quake in an ongoing series of such quakes. Jor-El decides the time has come to relocate the family to another home that has been reinforced against quakes. Lara is hesitant at first until Jor-El tells her that this quake is the quake he has been trying to warn the council of, the one that will mean the end of Krypton. As the couple with their child leaps from the window of their high-rise skyscraper, the building collapses behind them. Arriving at their reinforced home, they know they only have bored a short time because the massive uranium core of the planet will soon ignite and blow the planet apart. Jor-El has built a small prototype rocket able to carry one person. It was a test ship that was built to reach Earth, and if successful, Jor-El would have built a larger model. Unfortunately, the clock has run out, and Krypton is in its death throes. With seconds to spare, Kal-El is put into the rocket and launched into space. Krypton explodes. On Earth, at this time, many nations are engaged in the First World War. In just days following its launch, Kal-El's rocket lands on Earth and is found by John and Mary Kent from Smallville. The rocket consumes itself, leaving no evidence of its existence. The child is taken to an orphanage asylum, where Kal-El astounds everyone with his strength and agility. The Kents return to adopt him, to the great relief of the orphanage staff. Kal-El becomes Clark Kent. As young Clark Kent grows, his powers develop. John Kent counsels him to hide his abilities so people will not fear him. But when the time comes, he must use his powers to assist humanity. Young Clark finds he can leap up to an eighth of a mile, raise tremendous weights, run faster than a streamlined train, and nothing less than a bursting shell could penetrate his skin. Following the deaths of the Kents, Clark moves to Metropolis. And after seeing Billy Batson selling the Daily Star newspaper, he seeks a position as a reporter. Clark has absolutely no experience as a reporter, and editor George Taylor turns him down. Clark changes into his costume, which was made from his Kryptonian swaddling clothes, and listens to a call from outside George Taylor's window about a lynch mob headed for the county jail. Clark sees this as an opportunity to impress Taylor and land a job. The first time, Clark goes into action as Superman and heads for the jail. A man named Sims is accused of killing labor leader Jack Kennedy and is about to be hung by the mob. Superman swoops down and defeats the mob. After they refuse to listen to reason, he learns the true killer's identity and that an innocent woman, Evelyn Curry, will be executed within the hour. Clark calls in the story of the lynch mob to George Taylor and lands the job at the Daily Star. Superman confronts Bea Carroll, a nightclub singer. She pulls a gun on him, confesses to killing Kennedy, and plans to kill him too. Who wouldn't believe it was self-defense when a deranged character dressed in this costume bursts in? Superman grabs the gun and twists it into a pretzel. He obtains a written confession from her, and with a half hour to go, heads for the governor's mansion to stop the execution. Superman bursts into the governor's mansion. Through staff, steel doors, and gunfire, he reaches the governor and convinces him to stop the execution with minutes to spare. The next day, the governor holds a conference and discloses that Superman isn't human, but is apparently on the side of law and order. At the Daily Star, Clark is given the assignment to find out as much about Superman as possible. There he meets Lois Lane and takes her to dinner and dancing. The dance is interrupted by a thug named Butch, who wants to cut in on their dance. Clark plays timid, but Lois, disgusted with Clark, strikes Butch, enraging him. Butch and his mob chase down Lois's cab and run it off the road, kidnapping her. Superman chases them down, rescues Lois, and destroys Butch's car, a la the cover of Action Comics number 1. Superman leaves Butch hanging from a telephone pole and returns Lois to the city. The next day, when Lois tells her story to Taylor, against Superman's advice, Taylor assumes she's been drinking. While Lois initially despises Clark, he encourages it by keeping his identity a secret. Their relationship eventually changes for the better, and in the early 1950s, they are finally married. And that, my friends, is the secret origin of the Golden Age Superman.
I like this issue. I mean, I love this issue, if I'm perfectly honest. I think it's fantastic. I wish it didn't come to such a rather abrupt halt, because, I mean, you're really digging it and you're really enjoying it. And then all of a sudden it's just like, and eventually they became friends and got married. And, you know, so it's a very kind of abrupt ending to it. But it does, I mean, it covers a lot of ground. I guess it was just that it's so enjoyable and you get into it so much with you know, the way Roy Thomas is writing it. He's both being very, very faithful to the original story, but he's also putting, you know, more flesh on the bones too, and actually even addressing a couple of things that I don't know if you'd call it like continuity things, but just making a little more sense of things that maybe didn't make a lot of sense in the original story, or that, you know, as we would get to know Superman over the years, maybe just seem a little odd, you know, with that latter familiarity with the character, that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, just tiny little retcon type things. And I just would have liked to have seen this continue. I mean, imagine like this becoming a series right here. It would have been fantastic. But I mean, for what it is, you know, just retelling his origin in kind of the definitive way and pulling all that disparate material that we've just looked at together into one cohesive, definitive origin story, it's damn good. It does a really, really good job of that.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I really like how this starts out on the splash page. And, you know, the very first words are "The crisis on Infinite Earths has ended." And it just talks about, you know, the crisis having essentially wiped away this version of Superman and, you know, of this continuity and everything, and kind of, you know, giving us the reason why they're covering this and looking back, and that basically this Superman deserves to be remembered and honored and all that on the opening page before actually getting into the origin. And I just find it interesting that, you know, knowing what I know now about Roy Thomas's great disdain for the Crisis on Infinite Earths, I feel like the guy deserves major props for the fact that I never picked up on any of that in all the times I've read and reread this story over the years until I actually knew it for a fact. I never picked up on them. So I feel like he's being very professional here. You know, he never lets on that that he really did not like the idea of the crisis. He didn't like the, you know, what it did to Earth 2 and all of that. I think he did a really good job of kind of, you know, masking that. And that's pretty neat. That's very professional. It's much more professional than other writers were, how they were conducting themselves in the post-crisis era, I feel. I think it's awesome that they got Wayne Boring for the artist on this. You know, the combination of Wayne Boring and Jerry Ordway, what a hell of a team these guys make. It's beautiful to look at. The art in this is just fantastic. I mean, they really meld so well. I if memory serves, I think this is Wayne Boring's last project too. I could be wrong on that, but it's either the last one or one of the very last that he ever did. But you know, I mean, talk about going out with a bang. This is fantastic. I love the art in this. I love the look of the Daily Star, both in the opening splash and then again at the very last panel with Superman and Lois on their, you know, presumably on their wedding day, kind of flying through the city. It's just really cool because, you know, the Daily Star didn't have the big globe. It had, you know, basically a ring around a skyscraper type of thing. And it just really looks cool. I like that the race of Superman element of the origin is back here. I tend to like that origin the best. Although I could honestly do without the Jor-El like leaping around the city and all that. That element of it, I don't know why I find it a little bit weird or a little bit silly. I do. I like the idea of it being a race of Superman, but I don't need to see them, you know, doing the leaping and all that sort of thing.
So you would think nobody owns cars on Krypton.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the impression that it gives, is that they get around, you know, all the mobility is with them leaping all over the place. And I like the idea of, you know, the futuristic, you know, with monorails and rocket ships. And, you know, I like that version. So there is no emblem on Jor-El's chest, which I find very strange, but I do like the piping that they added. So he has like piping on both his tunic and then like down the leggings of his whatever they are, tights or pants or whatever. So it almost has like a kind of militaristic look to his outfit. I really like it, but I miss the big, you know, either the big sun or even I like the planet with the ring on it. That was always like, to me, you know, to my mind, that was always the Golden Age Jor-El, was the one that had the planet with the ring on it on his chest. But This is pretty cool, too. Page 7, third panel. I really think that Jonathan Kent right here looks like Glenn Ford from Superman the movie.
That was one of my notes, too.
And then the Jonathan Kent in the very next panel looks like John Byrne's Jonathan Kent. Now, I'm sorry?
I wonder if they did that on purpose.
Yeah, I wondered. I wondered on that, if maybe they're meant to be homages of some kind or something like that. I don't know. How close is Smallville supposed to be in Metropolis if you can see skyscrapers that big in the distance? Because that makes it look like it's like right outside the city.
That almost plays into something that the TV show would go with. That Smallville's literally like outside Metropolis.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of versions have done that in the comics. It was kind of nebulous a lot of times in the comics exactly where Smallville was supposed to be. It seemed to fit like the needs of the story. So sometimes it was very remote and, you know, very tiny and kind of off. And then other times it's like right outside the city. So I don't know. It was always kind of nebulous in that aspect, I guess.
I guess it would kind of be like if you put Smallville in upstate New York.
Right.
And had, you know, Manhattan be Metropolis. But to me, it works better where it's completely in the Midwest.
I like there's little touches of added dialogue, like at the bottom of page 7 where, you know, we get the hypodermic scene again, which is drawn in the same, you know, the same angles, the same style and everything as the classic origin. I really like this. And the doctor's saying, you know, how he's broke the sixth hypodermic needle, you know, trying to vaccinate Clark. And he says, try, you know, in the original version, all he says is, try again, doc. And this one, he says, try again, doc. They must be defective. I like that. Just, you know, a little bit of additional dialogue there. You have the same observation I had with the newsboy there, Billy Batson. Yeah, I thought the same thing, that he looks like Billy Batson.
They had to have done that on purpose.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking so. I could have done without the up, up, and away. I don't know why that bugs me, but it just does. I'm not sure where that... I guess that must come from the radio.
Definitely has to come from the radio.
Yeah. I never cared for that outside of, you know, the other media versions of Superman. That's one of those things they could have just left out of the comics. I don't know why it bugs me, but it just does. I like that. I don't know why he does it, but, you know, in Superman's very first appearance, you know, after he lands and he breaks up the mob and everything, the sheriff is right there, and he asks him, he says, who are you anyway? And Superman actually says, just a reporter. Like, dude, you just blew your secret identity. But I find that, I don't know, I like that. I find that very interesting that he would actually admit to being a reporter.
And then he takes out his press card.
Pages 12 and 13. I love the art in this. I love that they are basically doing their rendition with the same basic angles and artwork and everything as the classic first appearance in Action Number 1, you know, by Joe Shuster, you know, right down to the poses and everything. I mean, it's clearly their art, but just totally doing the same panels and everything, the same layouts and everything as the original. That's really cool. It gives it a really cool look. Let's see, page 14, seventh panel. Let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, it's the one where he's looking at the, Clark Kent is looking at the newspaper. So there's a little bit of extra dialogue, and it kind of confused me a little bit. So he's looking at the paper, and he says, and I'm not mentioned, good, which is exactly what he says in the original in Action Number 1, but then it has the additional dialogue of, but I wonder why not? And I'm just like, okay. But it doesn't go anywhere. You know, it's just, he kind of just wonders why he's not mentioned, but that's
see,
it.
See, I could see filling it in with the next scene going, you know, the governor and his advisors are like, clearly, this guy's not human. We need to keep this on the down low.
Right.
Because the public can't handle this.
Right. Keep it out of the papers. Yeah. That would have been an interesting way to go. It would have made more sense to go in that direction, I think. I really liked the cover of Action number one being incorporated into this telling. That's cool. That it's not quite a full page splash, but you know, it's a good like three quarters of a page, that shot of him actually smashing Butch's car. And the way, you know, the way he's smashing it, and then with the guys, you know, fleeing, and the guys, you know, holding his head in his hands as he runs away. I mean, it's exactly like the cover of Action One. I think that's so cool. I like that they worked that into the story.
I wish they would have made it green, though. The car green.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, the car is a different color, isn't it?
You know, and I went back to the actual issue because I said to myself, am I misremembering? Maybe in the original, the actual story had a different color car, but it's green in the story, just like on the cover.
Yeah, it is. I thought this was kind of odd. On page 20, the last panel on page 20, after he hangs Butch up on the telephone pole, there's a thought balloon where he says, "No two ways about it. If I'm not going to die of boredom, I'm going to have to find opponents worthier of my time." And I'm wondering, is that a comment on the Superman of the time, on Golden Age Superman, essentially? Because you and I were talking about this the other day. Now, you know, you and I are both doing read-throughs of Golden Age stuff. Now, I'm concentrating purely on Superman, and you're basically reading everything.
Right.
But knowing where that transition basically happens, where Superman becomes, you know, the Silver Age and more or less the quintessential version of Superman that everybody remembers, so, you know, with the Fortress of Solitude and Krypto and just all that stuff that would come along later in the Silver, you know, the Mort Weisinger era. You know, that doesn't happen for like well over a decade. So I'm wondering, like, what was Superman doing in this in-between? Like, right now, you and I are in the early 40s in our read-through. I mean, we've got well over a decade to go before we get to that Silver Age version of Superman, you know, the more or less quintessential version of him that everybody thinks of. So, I'm wondering, is that what he's doing? Is he's battling fraud and gangsters and bank robbers? I mean, is that what he's going to do for? Because,
well, what's odd is because you get the Ultra Humanite fairly early in the run,
right?
You get Luthor. Maybe you get one other character, but it's slipping my mind. But everything else is pretty much humans, you know, gangsters, right? Fifth columnists, spies, saboteurs.
Right.
And disasters. Crooked mine owners.
Right. So that makes me wonder. I mean, obviously it was enough to sustain the character through, you know, through all of that and everything. But I wonder how that's going to read, you know, from a modern perspective. I hope I don't get burned out before I make it to the era that I'm really itching, you know, the Silver Age stuff that I'm more familiar with, you know, a more familiar version of the character and all that. I'm just wondering, what did he essentially do during that whole period, you know, before all those Weisinger elements started to be injected into the character and basically change him, you know, as a character? It's going to be interesting to find out, because it's really a huge blind spot for me, you know, in my knowledge of the character.
And you're up to 43, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. I'm up to October of 41. I would have thought there would be a lot more, but it's going to be the same thing, even if it's war-related. It's going to be spies and saboteurs.
Right.
I guess maybe at the time that was, you know, the great concern of the day, and maybe it was a lot more interesting. We've been spoiled by the superpowered villain.
I don't know.
Look at it. Look how long it goes, where most issues end with the cops is still after him.
That went a lot. That lasted a lot longer than I thought it did too. And it was interesting that, you know, one of the versions of the origin that we just looked at, you know, had Pa Kent saying, you know, about, you know, working with the police and everything and always being on the side of law and order. And I'm thinking, well, that's not, you know, that's a bit of retconning right there, because that's not how he started out. You know, he started out as an outlaw, you know, pursued by the police for a lot of those early issues.
I mean, there's a recurring character, Sergeant Casey.
Yep.
Well, he's constantly trying to capture Superman. And it's just within, I would say, a few months of where I am now, where I think he saves Casey or something. And Casey is starting to come around to Superman.
Right. Yeah, I'm up to 1943 and just recently finally read a story where basically the police were finally saying, like, thank God for Superman. You know, hey, he's on our side type of thing. But up until that point, that hadn't been how they were treating him. He was a fugitive. It reminded me a lot of like early Spider-Man, you know, where Spider-Man's out there busting his ass, you know, to do the right thing and apprehend the bad guys and all that sort of thing. But every time, you know, the cops are, you know, they're taking pot shots at him and, you know, trying to capture him and, you know, treating him as an outlaw. Superman was exactly the same way in the early days. I found that kind of fascinating.
And think of the irony of all this, which I just sent you the other day. 2 years earlier than where you are, Batman's now been deputized by the police department.
Right. Yeah, pretty quickly they blunted both, you know. They turned them from, you know, from the edgy vigilantes essentially into, you know, forces of justice, you know, and basically adjuncts to the police type of thing. And that's really interesting to note that. And I can only imagine it's because they realized so much of their readership was kids. That's gotta have at least some impact or influence in that decision to, you know, to soften the edges of them a bit.
And maybe also to the war. You know, everyone coming into the service of the country in one way or another.
Right. What'd you have on this issue?
We covered a lot of it. I absolutely love the cover of this book. Hang on, let me get to the cover so I can intelligently discuss this. Here we are. You know, at first glance, the cover's not very impressive. Like, if you're just spinning through the spinner rack, maybe it catches your eye, maybe it doesn't, because it's a dark cover. You know, it's got a black background. And to be blunt with you, when I first bought this particular issue, I wasn't overly impressed with it. But the more you look back at it, and you kind of understand what everything is, I wasn't a big fan of I was just starting to learn about the JSA when this hit the rack for me. Because I think it's one of the last crossovers before the crisis that I met the JSA.
Right.
And I discovered, oh, I really like this group, so they did away with them. But when you know what you're looking at, where you can see it's the Spectre, and it's the Earth 2 Wonder Woman, and J. Garrick the Flash, and Dr. Fate, looking at the crystal ball that's reminiscent of Justice League 21, the cover, where they're having the seance. Like looking back through the wisps of time to the beginning, and you can see Superman. It's clearly the Golden Age Superman with the gray, you know, by his sides, where we're all getting. It's just, you know, he's like, you could see almost the pained look as he's looking back, seeing his past.
And the Huntress, you know, the Huntress is there too. You know, she has her back to us, but that's clearly...
That was the one I couldn't identify. I wasn't sure.
That's a character who was wiped out by the crisis on Infinite Earths.
Just now when you said that, I see the points from her mask. I missed that before. So, yeah, this is a fantastic cover to me. I think it's great. And I love the car is green, like it was in the real. It's fantastic. I love this cover to me. This is an A, this cover. I mean, the rest of my notes are pretty much, you know, we covered them. The ring around the Daily Star building, the superpowered Jor-El, Glenn Ford vibe, John and Mary Kent. I've covered everything. The cover's an A to me.
I would like to know the secret origin of this title. Now, it's talked about in the back of the book. You know, I think it's Roy Thomas that wrote the article in the back, talking about, you know, what they're planning to cover and that sort of thing. But it doesn't, you know, of course, they were never going to dish dirt, you know, in these type of things. But I would like to know, how in the hell did Roy Thomas convince whoever to greenlight a series right after the crisis has just ended and they've officially done away with Earth 2? Mm-hmm. And everything Earth 2 related is eventually going to change great, you know, like, because All-Star Squadron was still ongoing, but it really hit that book hard, and also Infinity Inc. So those books are going to mutate a lot, to a point where essentially All-Star gets killed, and Infinity Inc. would go on for quite a ways, but it would change greatly because of Earth 2 going away, and DC almost immediately started to mandate that there's certain things that could no longer be talked about, could no longer be referenced, that sort of thing. Yet here's a title immediately after the crisis ends, and every other issue is going to focus on the origin of a character that was wiped away by the crisis on Infinite Earth. So it's, I mean, how did he pull that off?
Especially when you look back at a series that I really enjoy, Who's Who.
Right.
Where in those first issues you had Batman, the Golden Age, you know, Earth 1 and then Earth 2.
Right.
It gave you both. By the time it got to Superman, it was only, I think, the John Byrne Superman.
Yep. Which always irritated the hell out of me, because in all the earlier issues, if you're reading through, it would reference, you know, Superman 1, meaning the Earth 1 Superman. But then when that issue finally hits, the Superman they're referencing as Superman 1 is now the John Byrne Superman, which those references no longer refer to that specific Superman. So there should have been three. There should have been Earth 1, Earth 2, and then whatever they want to call it.
Earth, whatever.
Yeah. And they didn't do it that way. I saw somewhere somebody, and I have no idea who did it, but somebody actually came up with a mock-up Who's Who entry for Superman of Earth 1, essentially. And it was very well done. And I wish that somehow that could be made, like, official, you know, so you can, like, inject it into that series, because that's really the way they should have done it. They did a big disservice to the character and the fans by doing it that way, because the John Byrne Superman does not match up at all with, you know, Earth 1 Superman lore. So anybody that, see, that's what confuses me, is between things like that, and then things like this book, any new readers that they picked up from Crisis, you know, anybody that wanted to come in either at the Crisis or immediately after with something like, say, Man of Steel number 1 as a jumping on point, wouldn't this just confuse the shit right out of them?
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is, when I bought this issue, I was, what, this was 86? 1986, right? Mm-hmm. I was on my way of bailing out of comics. I was 15. And I remember buying this because I saw Secret Origins, and then I got it home and I started to read it, and I was like, there's nothing secret about this. This is just a retelling of what I already, and I remember at the time being rather annoyed about that. And I don't even think at the time, in years since, I've read it and reread it, and I can appreciate it much better. But at the time, I felt it was more of a misnomer.
Right.
I would still like to know how he got the name Kal-El. How does he know that's his name?
Right. Yeah, we never were able to answer that one.
Well, maybe we'll come across something in some other forum.
Well, did we want to do grades on this one?
Sure, why not? We're here, aren't we?
Yeah.
For me, grades is going to be very simple. The cover, I already said, I didn't bury the lead. It's an A to me. The interior art, I love the art. I think it's beautiful. I love they took the time on that first splash page to throw all the key elements in. You see Krypton exploding with the three moons. You see the rocket coming to Earth, the Daily Star, and on his chest is clearly the symbol from the Golden Age.
Right.
I like the art. I think the art is fantastic. I give the art an A as well. And the story is iconic. It's a retelling. It's told well. It adds just enough little extras in there to really make it pop. A on that. Overall grade, an A.
Yep. I'm just going to echo you on that. I feel exactly the same. I think it's A's across the board. I think especially the art. The interior art is the thing that I love the most. I think Boring and Ordway made just a hell of a team. I would have loved to have seen more of this. I mean, if they wanted to keep this team on and you know, do more installments, maybe make this a mini series, I would have loved that, because I was really sad to see it just kind of end with that, you know, with the end panel there, because I was like, oh, give me more. This is fantastic. I was really enjoying it. I think it's a solid issue. It's really, really cool.
It would have been great if it was like a four-issue miniseries.
Yeah.
Where they hit the four key points in his life.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I would have really enjoyed that. Yeah, you know, real quick before we go, I want to look that up real quick. Is this the last Wayne Boring? Because that's tickling my brain that it is, but I can't remember exactly, but I think so. I think this is his last work. Because I want to say he passed away not long after this. So there was one more story published after this that had his art in... what would that be? September of the same year, 86. All-Star Squadron number 64. Actually, this is a really cool issue I'd love to do on a show sometime. In that story, they actually retell an old Superman story, but they retell it as a post-crisis story. So basically, how did this adventure happen if the Golden Age Superman had never existed, which he didn't after the crisis. So it's actually the penciler on it is Wayne Boring, who I think did the original story, I think. And the inker was Tony DiZaniga, and they actually make a pretty good team on it. And it's a really cool story because it hits all the same beats as the original story. It's just it doesn't have Superman in it, and it was really well done. I actually reread this not long ago, and it was pretty cool.
Huh. That would be interesting to read.
Yeah, but that's the last thing, at least on Mike's Amazing World. That's the last thing attributed to him that is not a reprint, you know, during his lifetime. Because I'm pretty sure. Let me look that up real quick. I'm pretty sure he passed away in 86, 87, 88, somewhere in that era. 87, yeah, early 87, February 20th, 87. So, yeah, he was 82. Or not yet 82, he was 81. Hell of an artist, though.
Oh, absolutely. To have such staying power and to be so good for so long.
Yep. I love his stuff. I have ever since I was a kid. And that's, you know... That's even with, like I say, you know, I generally had especially as a kid, a really big disdain for Golden Age stuff of any kind. You know, the stories, the art, everything. But he, you know, he stood above all that. I right from the get go, I've always liked his stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you have to mature a bit in your comic, you know, reading and collecting to appreciate the Golden Age.
Right.
Because I was right there with you. I bought back, and when did they start bringing out? You remember the archive editions?
Right, right.
I mean, that had to be, what, the early 90s? Could it even be the late 80s?
Yeah, somewhere in that era, yeah.
And I bought all those, and I remember sitting there trying to read them back then, 20, 30 years ago, and being like, oh, gee, I can't get through this.
Aren't the archives the ones where they took old comics and they did the Greg Theakston process, right? Where they took, like, Action Number 1 and Superman Number 1 and so, and they actually cut them up and, like they would cut them into strips. And then they used some sort of process that would bleach all the color out, leaving them with basically the black and white art and the ink. And then they would, I don't know, it was some process. It was called Theakstonization after Greg, the artist or whatever he was, Greg Theakston. It was a process he came up with for basically preserving old comics. But in order to do it, They literally had to destroy old comics.
Jeez.
And this had to be late 80s, early 90s, because that's when I was in the service. And I can remember during that time writing several very irritated articles to Comic Buyer's Guide that actually got published, bitching about Theakstonization and how much I thought it was just a travesty that they're cutting up issues of, like, Action Comics Number 1, you know, just to turn around to be able to reprint it. Now, I understand that they were doing that to try to make, like, the most, you know, the most beautiful presentation possible, but, I mean, that's too high a cost, man.
Right.
You know? I still think my understanding was that that what's his name, Greg Theakston, thought that was just hysterical, you know, that people were getting incensed by what he was doing. But yeah, I still stand by that. I think that was a pretty, I don't know, I think somebody should have stopped him, you know.
Well, you would have thought there would be an easier way of doing it even back then,
right?
I mean, they had copiers back then. There should have been a more primitive way to scan it in and then clean it up however you wanted.
Right. You would think.
What do
well,
I
mean, know? that was back before scanners. That was back before, you know, Photoshop and stuff like that. So, I guess. Plus, back then, you know, as expensive a book as it would have been, you know, you didn't have, you know, it wasn't fetching $1.5 million or whatever it fetches today, you know. I'm sure it was thousands and thousands of dollars, but it hadn't quite hit that mark yet, you know.
Yeah, well, you think he still thinks it's a good idea seeing what Action Comics goes for now?
I'm pretty sure he's dead now. But, yeah. But I was looking here on the wiki for Wayne Boring. It says he died of a heart attack following a brief comeback announced in one of his last published works, penciling a Golden Age Superman story written by Roy Thomas and inked by Jerry Ordway. In Secret Origins Volume 2, I think there's more than two volumes. Anyway, they say Volume 2, Number 1, April 1986. His final work was All-Star Squadron Number 64, a recreation of Superman Number 19. And that's why I reread it recently, because I just read Superman Number 19 within the past year as I'm doing this read-through. And after I read that story, I'm like, I swear I've read this story before, and I got to thinking about it, and somehow or other that, you know, by tracking it down, it led me to Action, to All-Star Squadron 64, and I was like, oh, I was right, I had read this story before. And that's where I realized that it was, you know, the post-crisis retelling. And I don't know, I'm just kind of fascinated by that whole thing, because after the crisis, I would often think of stories or read stories and wonder, how the hell did this story happen post-crisis? And I like that sort of thing, you know?
I remember that being something at some point, filling in, well, who took that person's place that no longer exists?
Right, right. Well, what do we got for next time?
Next time we're going to go back to, hang on. It will not be a Superman issue. We will be covering the Crimson Avenger.
Sweet.
And we have two books designated towards this. His first appearance, which is Detective Comics number 20 from October 1938, and Secret Origins number 5 from August 1986.
Very cool.
Hopefully you'll all join us for that.
I'm looking forward to that. That should be cool. I always thought he was a pretty cool character.
I did too.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.